It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Construction is underway on a venue in Janesville that will contain a two-sheet ice arena, multi-sports complex, and convention space. We discuss the economic outlook for the Woodman's Center and surrounding Rock County. And you can call in with a question. Share your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Christine Rebout is Executive Director of the Janesville Area Convention and Visitors Bureau and co-chair of the Friends of the Woodman's Center. Christine, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
And Kevin Lehner here as well, Janesville City Manager. Kevin, welcome back.
Thank you.
Kevin, let's start with you. Demolition being underway at the site of the old Sears store at the Janesville Uptown Mall. Can you tell us about how this project is being funded?
Well, the project actually has several different partners, and it's just a wonderful partnership of the private sector and the public sector coming together to build the project. So obviously the city is a large funder, put in $15.3 million plus $2 million for design. And the state of Wisconsin, through ARPA funds, funded $15 million. And then there was just an amazing private sector fundraising effort by the Friends of the Woodman Center that has raised more than $9 million for the project and continues to grow. And then there was a federal appropriation from Senator Tammy Baldwin that was $5 million. And a contribution from the Janesville Jets, as well as a few others. And so it's just a great example of an incredible partnership. So the total cost is going to be around $46.7 million when it's all said and done.
Has this project been impacted by inflationary costs?
Yeah, you know what? We were very worried about that as we were going through the process. And thankfully, when our bids came in for the construction, the construction costs had stabilized. And so they actually came in under our budget. And we were very thankful that we had three very strong competitive bids. And our local contractor, Cullen, was the one that won the bids. But we were very happy with how the bids came in.
Christine, how important is this project for Janesville? Hey, Christine, can you hear us? I think we're having some difficulty getting Christine, but I will pose that then to you, Kevin, as we get Christine back on the line here. You know, how important is this project for the community?
Well, I mean, it's very important. The site of the project is Uptown Janesville, which is a mall property, and those mall properties are, you know, seeing declines. And this is an incredibly important corridor for us. And so this is just a great opportunity to introduce new life to that property and spur economic development in the city, as well as provide just an incredible community venue for our residents. We are predicting that there'll be more than $23 million in an initial impact for the site. And we are just very, very excited about that. We think that the center is going to create roughly 228 jobs, attract visitors from all over the region. And we're just very, very excited about what sort of impact the project will have.
Christina, I knew you're there now, but can you speak to the revitalizing a shopping mall area that's been closed or abandoned? Because many communities are grappling with this. How could this new facility affect the Janesville Uptown Mall?
This project really will have a tremendous impact on that corridor. We know it's just going to breathe new life into the businesses there. From a tourism standpoint, we know when people come for whether it's a conference or a sporting event, they're going to spend other money while they're there. We all know that we spend a little extra money on something we forgot or some extra shopping. So it really gives an opportunity to take those tourism jobs, whether they be retail or restaurant jobs, and make them permanent full-time jobs. And that's the kind of revitalization we're looking for, because that brings that money throughout the rest of the community.
That's Christine Rebout, who leads the area's Convention and Visitors Bureau. Kevin Lehner is Janesville City Manager. As we talk about construction of a combined sports facility and convention center in Janesville, call in with questions and comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. I want to find out, Christine, a little bit more about that fundraising piece of this project, that upwards of $9 million, and I understand growing. You have a title sponsor of the facility in Woodman's. I'm wondering, does Woodman's have locked-in naming rights forever with like a one-time donation, or how does that work?
The donation for Woodman's naming rights was an exciting one for us. Woodman's is an employee-owned company, so it was really an opportunity to have the local people play a role. Now, that sponsorship will renew in 20 years, but we're delighted to have them come in at that large amount. Like you said, we've still got sponsorships open, but we're also grateful to Mercy Health System, Kennedy Family Foundation, all of those sponsors who have made this 9.7 a reality, largest private fundraising campaign in the Janesville community, and really a testament to how this is good for the overall community.
What was it like to get those major sponsors on board? I mean, you certainly have, you know, the synergy of a community. What was that process like?
It was really an emotional roller coaster for us. We had a COVID pause. We started our fundraising, and like so many community development projects, had that COVID pause. So when those large donors came in, it was a pretty emotional event for us because it's a passion project for so many of us. So we were really grateful and excited for those donors of whatever size. We know people give in the ways that they can. So we were really excited when each of those donations came in. But those three major sponsors really showed a testament to the Janesville community.
Kevin, you have some knowledge base now on these public-private partnerships. What's your advice for other communities wanting to pursue large projects through this type of partnership?
You know, I think that it's just really important to be engaged with the business community. The thing that we have in Janesville that's just so incredible is a sense of community and a sense of connection with the business community leaders and the local government, which is not always the case. And that is a result of just a lot of work by a lot of good people over many, many years trying to make positive impacts in the community. Janesville is just incredibly exciting place right now. Through public-private partnerships, we've been able to do a bunch of revitalization in our downtown. And that work just continues. And it's just an amazing effort for that to happen. And so my advice would be is to engage with your business leaders early and often, have really strong conversations about the needs of the community and listen. And those are the types of things that really make this sort of thing happen. And I have to tell you, this level of fundraising is remarkable. And as a city manager, I'm incredibly grateful to our local businesses for stepping up.
Christine, ice rink here, like ice rinks really lead a bit of this project. You've got also the Janesville Jets hockey team and then a venue for conventions. Is it unusual at all to see this type of pairing in a single facility?
This pairing is a little bit unique. Usually you see a focus on one or the other and they're separate facilities. For us, we knew we wanted this facility to be able to be used 365, 24/7. If somebody wants a 2 a.m. meeting, darn it, we're going to make that work because we wanted the most economic impact for the investment. And we really, this came about with parallel paths. The Convention and Visitor Bureau and their strategic planning in 2018 said we really need to move the needle in the off season. So in January, February, a reason to have people come into town because snow is not dependable in Wisconsin. And at the same time, the Janesville Jets and some of the hockey community said, we need a facility. So we happened to all be in the room at the same time and said, we need to move both these things forward. Let's do it together and make it a major revitalization project. And one supports the other. People might come for a hockey event and say, gosh, you know, my corporate meeting would fit great in that other facility. Let's think about that. So this is a project that will be looked at throughout the Midwest as a way to not only create, you know, economic revitalization, but also a way to combine facilities and make the best investment.
That is Christine Rebout, who leads the Janesville Area Convention and Visitors Bureau. Kevin Lehner is here, city manager of Janesville, as we get a preview of the Woodman Sports and Convention Center with construction underway in southern Wisconsin. Call in with a question. You can add your thoughts at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Woodman's Sports and Convention Center is projected to be an economic driver for Janesville and southern Wisconsin, and we learn what's in store as the project is expected to be completed next year. Be part of the discussion. Call in with a question. Share your perspective. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Christine Rebout, Executive Director of the Janesville Area Convention and Visitors Bureau, is here, along with Kevin Lehner, Janesville City Manager. Kevin, getting your sense here on the hockey element, the Janesville Jets, a Tier 2 junior ice hockey team, and the team has competed in the North American Hockey League for 15 years. So it has an ice arena at the Janesville Ice Arena, built in 1974. What is the condition of that 50-year-old ice arena?
Yeah, so that's one of the drivers of the project, obviously, is that we recognize that that facility was just no longer viable as a, you know, as a hockey facility. We were going to either have to make tens of millions of dollars of investment to redo that facility. It's older than I am already. And so that was one of the discussions, was how do we, you know, what is the best use of our investment? And through the combination of the public-private partnerships, we were able to create what we think is going to be a premier facility and continue that partnership with the Jets, which have been just an incredible community partner. Bill McCoshin is owner of the Jets, principal owner of the Jets, and he has just been a great advocate for the project as well. And the folks in Janesville love the Jets. Their games are a ton of fun. People pack the current facility, and we can't wait to get them into their new arena and open that up for their season once the project is completed. So we're really excited about what that brings to the table. And of course, there is the support for the Janesville Area Youth Hockey Program mm-hmm. as well, which is just going to be excellent in the new facility.
But I wonder, excellent in the new facility, I mean, maintaining ice rinks, that is not without input costs. And so I wonder, how will cash flow work here? Will there be enough operating revenue for maintenance and upgrades?
Yeah, so that is a great question. We've done multiple studies over the course of several years on that to try to figure out, you know, is it going to be profitable? And we think that it's going to be very successful. Our prediction shows that it's going to take about 60,000 in dollars from city funds to help operate it, but otherwise would be able to support itself through the different tournaments, the different concession sales, the conventions, etc. And so we spent a lot of time looking into that, figuring out what the best options were for how to run the facility. And we're going through the process of determining how the facility is going to be managed once it's opened.
Right. I mean, because Christine, you have to balance the needs of the community who want to use it with outside groups that wish to rent it, perhaps at a higher cost, that are not local. And so how do you strike that balance?
I think that really falls with the balance that we've had in fundraising. We've made it a community partnership. So we know there'll be times when we have a large scale event coming in, but hopefully we work that calendar and we work together with the community. One of our first groups coming in will be a local fundraiser for a nonprofit organization, but you know, we'll bring them in at a lower cost, but hopefully the people who come and attend, it serves as PR and marketing for us. We know it's always going to be a balance, but with the size and the design of the facility, we know that one part can support the other. So while there might be a lower cost nonprofit organization in one section of the facility, there might be a great pickleball tournament in another that's bringing in the economic impact for it. So the goal in design was to create enough areas in the facility that we could support, you know, the other events coming into it at a lower cost.
Wait, how many pickleball courts? You just said something really shiny and glittery over here.
We didn't add alternate. We started out with 16, and Kevin, maybe you can help me if we're up to 18 or 20 pickleball courts now. But I know the minute I said the word pickleball, the state of Wisconsin would have a little bit of a sigh and some excitement when I said those words.
Kevin, do you have anything to add about that?
Well, number one,
yeah, I mean, you forgot the most essential piece of public-private investment, which is another P, which is pickleball.
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously, we're very excited about pickleball. When it comes to pickleball courts, you build it and they will come. It is incredibly exciting. And that's the great thing about the facility is that it has so much different uses that we can put there. So it can be a sports facility. I mean, it can obviously host hockey tournaments, but as you mentioned, it can host a pickleball tournament. It can host, a regular pickleball league in the facility. And one of the sheets of ice is actually going to be used for multi-purposes when it's not hockey season. So it just gives folks like Christine the ability to sell the space in different ways, which we think is just a great benefit to the facility and is going to make us unique as compared to others in the state and in the region.
Talking about the construction of a combined sports facility and convention center in Janesville with pickleball in the mix, Kevin Lehner there, Janesville's city manager. Kristen Rebout leads the area's Convention and Visitors Bureau. Call in with questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Christine, when we talked about operating revenue, I'm wondering what is the role here of Convention and Visitors Bureau? I mean, you have the hotel room tax revenue. Will that go at all toward this project in ongoing costs?
We sell the entire Janesville community, and now we have a new tool in the toolbox in the Woodman Sports and Convention Center, and we know it's going to complement all of our hotels and facilities, so absolutely, we'll be working hard to fill that facility. And I'd be remiss if I didn't say everybody listening can play a role in that, because we said the magic word pickleball, but we also know organizations like Wisconsin Broadcasters. All of those meetings and conventions need a home to go to, and we don't like to see when they head to Illinois or a nearby state. We want to keep them here in Wisconsin. So this is our opportunity at the Convention and Visitors Bureau to really sell. So many people in the project said, oh, you know, you've almost completed your fundraising. Can you relax now? I said, absolutely not. Now we begin to sell the facility and the Janesville community, which, as we said, benefits hotels, attractions, restaurants, and all of the people who support them.
Kevin, what do you say to property taxpayers who object to paying for this facility, especially those who aren't like hockey fans or convention goers?
Yeah, so there's a couple of different things on that. We've been very clear and open about the impacts to the community as a whole. The average taxpayer is going to pay about $39 annually in additional tax to support the facility. And that is a very low number, considering that we're going to have a $46 million asset to be able to use. And then the other thing that's really key is that it is a community facility. And so the fact that it's city run is going to give us just opportunities to do all sorts of programming for our community as a whole. Mm. And so our recreation folks do an incredible job now providing opportunities for seniors and for young people and for everybody in between. And this just gives us another tool to be able to provide those services as well. And so we think that the fact that it's going to be a community asset and then the economic growth that it will create around the Milton Avenue corridor will offset those tax costs that we will incur when we initially build it and fund the debt.
Christine, in our last moments together, Shannon and Racine is calling in, used to live in Janesville, has an ice skating background, and have you considered figure skating competitions in this venue?
Figure skating has been at the table in the initial design part of the program, and we know that we have opportunities for all or ice sports. We have some strong figure skating and some great events that we do now with them, so we're delighted to bring figure skating to the table for that.
Okay, so that too is in the mix. Shannon, thank you for calling in. And Christine and Kevin, thank you so much for joining us and sharing about this project.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Christine Rebout is Executive Director of the Janesville Area Convention and Visitors Bureau, as well as co-chair of the Friends of the Woodman Center. Kevin Lehner is Janesville City Manager. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As Wisconsin lakes thaw earlier, it's disrupting the ability for walleye to thrive. We explore a new study on the walleye population. But first, in the fall, four UW River Falls students died by suicide in less than 2 months. And this semester, campus officials are offering counseling and mental health events. Corrine Hess reports some students say they want more.
It's another Mental Health Monday on the UW River Falls campus. About 30 students are gathered at the University Center. The theme of this Mental Health Monday is sleep. Some are making aromatherapy oils. Others spin a wheel to win a sleep mask. Counselors want students to understand relaxation and healthy sleep habits are linked to better mental health. These student gatherings are part of the university's response to a series of suicides on campus. In the fall, four UW River Falls students died by suicide in less than 2 months. Students say they're happy to have Mental Health Mondays, but they're looking for more.
It's a great way to bring people together, but nobody talks about the suicides that happened last semester.
That's freshman Chloe Skilly. She says she understands people are trying to move on, but losing four classmates in 8 weeks was unprecedented. Campus officials say the students' deaths were not directly linked. They're treating them as a suicide cluster because of the connections on the small campus. And that meant taking steps to avoid copycat suicides. Mental Health Mondays are one part of those efforts. Administrators have also made counselors available and even identified students on campus who could be at risk. But some students feel like they've been cut off from their ability to discuss the deaths. During winter break, campus officials removed a student-created memorial wall filled with handwritten notes and flowers. They say this was in line with mental health professionals' recommendations. Freshman RJ Forja says the memorial was a place students could sit with their emotions.
People heal and grow after like such a loss, but like no one wants to forget about it. We're still like ready and willing to have these conversations.
Chancellor Maria Gallo says the university is not stopping students from having conversations about those who died, but she says those conversations are more appropriate in smaller groups.
Very personal and tragic circumstances, and I think that the students don't always realize that that's how it has to be, and it's the right thing to do to respect the families.
At the 5,000-person campus, many of the students knew at least one of the people who died last year. Annie Loss had classes and was in the same dorm as two of the women who died. Loss says she was worried about returning to school this semester because of her own struggles with mental health. She's a biochemistry major and said the pressure is sometimes too much to handle.
Classes are extremely difficult. every class I go into and the harder they get, I feel dumber and dumber. Mental health-wise, it's still really challenging to get through.
The mental health crisis at UW-River Falls is not unique to the campus. It's mirrored across the state and country. According to federal data, between 2007 and 2021, the suicide rate among people aged 24 and younger increased 62%. In Wisconsin, a recent survey from the state's Office of Children's Mental Health found 1 in 10 teens attempted suicide last year. The report found many young people feel stress or even hopelessness about issues like academic pressure, gun violence, and climate change. Loss says her friends and parents help her deal with anxiety and mental health struggles. She's hoping the focus UW-River Falls has placed on mental health will continue beyond this year. Corrine Hess, Wisconsin Public Radio.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The State Department of Natural Resources has a new 3-fish bag limit on walleye caught in inland waters for the license year starting in April. It marks a reduction from 5 walleye a day. And this comes as a new study finds Wisconsin's warming winters cause stress to the walleye population. Call in with a question. You can add your thoughts, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Zach Viner is a research scientist at the DNR and UW-Madison's Center for Limnology. Zach, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So the Wisconsin State Climatology Office tells WPR this is likely to be the warmest winter ever recorded in Wisconsin, and you're finding walleye are struggling to adapt to the changing climate. Why is this fish under stress?
Sure. So walleye spawn has been historically pretty tightly linked to when the ice melts off the lake or ice off. And we think the reason for that is because they are spawning to kind of time the hatching of their young to be around when there's food availability. So the ice off triggers a series of events in lakes where you get algae production, and then you also get zooplankton production, which are these little tiny crustaceans that feed baby fish. And then the baby fish hatch, and then there's zooplankton around eat. And what we think is happening here is that because we're getting more very extremely early and extremely late ice off years, we think all of those events are coming out of sync now. So now these baby fish are hatching, and in a really early year like this one, they're actually hatching in a mistimed from their zooplankton food, and then they don't have enough food to survive and grow. So, and that's actually going to hurt the ability of these walleye populations to produce that next generation of fish.
Oh, because it's a much larger ecosystem here of dynamics when you have these warming waters. What is the optimum water temperature for walleye?
Sure. So walleye like to spawn when it's, you know, somewhere between 5 and 10 degrees Celsius, which I apologize, I can't do the conversion to Fahrenheit off the top of my head. And they're also considered kind of a cool water fish. So they like water that's a little bit cooler than, say, like a bluegill or a bass, which we call a warm water fish. So walleye, you know, like to temperatures in the, you know, low 20s degrees Celsius to kind of grow and survive. But spawning, they're really looking for that 5 to 10 degrees Celsius window. And what that means is that when you get those years that are very early or very late, those temperatures can come at really different periods of time. So, for example, we've had years where that's come as early as March, like this year, and we've had years where that's come as late as, you know, May, mid-May. So that's a 2-month difference from one year to the next. And when you get these huge swings in kind of when all these events start to take place, you can get kind of a scrambling of their succession, and that's what we're thinking is causing these issues with walleye.
Okay, and that 5 to 10 degrees Celsius, thanks to our technical director, Lee, that is 40 to 50 degrees Fahrenheit. I mean, can you talk about the temperature needs for the walleye eggs to, like, ripen and stand a better chance at survival?
Yeah, so walleye are actually really interesting in that they seem to need these really cold winters, these long winters, to get ready to spawn in the first place. Hmm. So they're actually putting energy into their eggs during the wintertime. And then when that spring happens, then they're ready to spawn. So on one side of things, you're actually having the effects of these short winters could actually reduce the ability of walleye to put energy into their eggs, get those eggs ready to be spawned in the first place. And then on this other half of this, after the eggs have been laid, now you may have their development that's really influenced by temperature, right? If it's very warm, they might develop and hatch really quickly, maybe in a week. If it's very cold, it might take them a few weeks up to a month to hatch.
Oh,
what that means is that these spring temperatures can have really strong effects of the timing of both when the eggs are laid in the first place and then when those eggs hatch. And that can then influence their ability to kind of match up with the abundance of their prey and stuff like that. So like you said, it's a whole kind of ecosystem perspective on how much our changing kind of spring seasons are influencing how these lakes are able to kind of support walleye and support the food resources that they need.
What about the possibilities for adaptation? Could walleye adapt to the changing climate with more time?
So I think the short answer to that is maybe, but I think the more complicated answer to that is that the climate is simply changing way too fast for walleye to be able to adapt. So one of the things that we found in this paper is that we looked at the kind of long-term trends in ice off timing and walleye spawning timing. And when I say timing, I mean phenology. So phenology is a study of the timing of seasonal events, like flowers blooming, fish spawning, ice melting, leaf out of trees, you know, that kind of thing. So what we found is that if you look at the long-term trends, ice off is getting earlier, which you'd expect, warmer springs, earlier ice offs, 3.5 times faster than walleye spawning is. So walleye spawning is not changing nearly as fast as ice off. So over time, they're actually starting to fall behind the pace of climate change and the pace of our changing springs, which really suggests that, you know, they don't have that capacity to adapt at the speed at which they would have to be able to keep up with climate change. We're just simply changing our springs too quickly for them to be able to keep track of it.
Digging a little bit more into the methodology of your study, you reviewed ice records and spawning reports from 194 lakes in the Midwest. And, you know, we're home to thousands of Midwestern lakes. Why pick the ones you did?
Yeah, I mean, the answer to that is really data availability, right? I mean, so we're very lucky in Wisconsin and the upper Midwest to have incredible ice off records for some lakes. You know, Mendota, for example, it goes back, I think, 175 years. It's amazing. We also have North Temperate Lakes Long-Term Ecological Research Project that the UW-Madison Center for Limnology has going. It's been going on for 40-some years now. We have a research station at the DNR up at Escanaba Lake that's been going for coming up on 75 or 76 years now. So we have great ice off data from some places. And then the other half of that was we also have really good walleye data from some places. So the DNR, Glyphwick, which is the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. And also we got some data from tribal fishers and when they're going out and harvesting walleye because they're targeting the spawning runs. And what we had to do is kind of overlay those two. And that's how we came up with 194 lakes. So it really boiled down to where do we have the data on walleye and ice, and where do we have enough data to be able to kind of detect the trends that we were interested in looking at.
So you kind of took that patchwork approach and chose places that really had some deep, deep history of recording, whether it's ice off records or walleye.
Right, yeah. We ended up choosing lakes that had at least 11 years of data. So it's not, you know, centuries of data, but 11 years is what we found allowed us to be able to statistically detect the trends that we were interested in, those changes in over time, changes in unpredictability or variability over time. So we were able to really, I think, you know, 194 lakes compared to 15,000 lakes in Wisconsin doesn't sound like much. But if you look across the literature, it's a really huge, really cool data set. We're able to cover lakes across Michigan, Minnesota, and Wisconsin. So it's a region-wide analysis. It was really powerful.
Zach Viner is a research scientist at the DNR and UW-Madison Center for Limnology, co-author of this study on walleye spawning. Call in with a question. You can add your thoughts along the way at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. New research on walleye connects poor reproduction with fluctuating dates for spring ice out on lakes in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Minnesota. And Wisconsin's warming winters affect the ecological balance of freshwater ecosystems, particularly for native fish species like walleye. Call in with a question. You can add your perspective at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. We have Zach Feiner with us, research scientist at the DNR and UW-Madison Center for Limnology. Zach, starting in April, there's a new bag limit in Wisconsin, saying anglers may only catch 3 walleye in inland waters per day. And the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reports that that's the biggest change in walleye fishing since at least 1949. Will the lower bag limit help walleye populations?
I think that's certainly, you know, part of the hope for that, right? We've seen declines in walleye reproduction for the past couple of decades now. And a lot of the things that we've tried, like stocking and other things, you know, are effective in some places, maybe not as effective in others. And so one of the options we have when we think, and we think about these effects are climate related, or at least partially climate related. And so one of the things we think about when thinking about how to deal with climate change is, well, let's control the things we can control, right? Because it's hard to control the amount of carbon in your atmosphere if you're kind of at the side of your lake. But when you're fishing on your lake, you can control how many fish you keep, or you can control, you know, what you can manage the spawning habitat. So this is another way to kind of control the things we can control and try and boost the resiliency of walleye populations to things we can't, like climate change. So, you know, we're always monitoring these populations. Walleye are one of the best studied fish in Wisconsin. We do spend a ton of resources on them to try and understand their population trajectories. And this is something that we can try and do to reduce harvest and boost their resiliency to climate change or other things that are outside of management control.
Let's bring in Marty in Richmond, Illinois. Marty, what's on your mind?
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. You know, I don't know if it's zooplankton or zooplankton, but aren't they adapting to the changing climate? You know, kind of like along the lines of that survival of the fittest kind of thing?
Marty, thanks for that question. Zach?
That's a super interesting question. So what it seems like is that different animals, like zooplankton versus fish, by actually using slightly different information to tell them like when to hatch or when to spawn. So for example, if zooplankton are more based on temperature or more based on day length, so our longer days in the spring is a major trigger for a lot of these springtime events, versus walleye, which are maybe using, you know, maybe they're more based on day length versus more based on temperature for zooplankton, that can lead to that kind of decoupling of these kinds of things and this kind of scrambling of their timing in the springtime. So it's possible that different animals are adapting at different rates. They're using different information. So when we see really extreme years, they're doing very different things. They're not all just kind of tracking along the same way. It's a super fascinating question, and we're trying to get a project going to actually look at that very thing. So you're thinking about the right ideas there, absolutely.
You also mentioned stocking of walleye in lakes. Have those made any inroads or successes, or is that something viable?
So stocking is definitely a possible solution, but I think it's just one of many. And there are places that where stocking probably won't be able to support walleye population. So stocking is something that I think a lot of people point toward, because it's the idea of you're adding more fish, you should get more fish. But what we found is that stocking success in lakes, the survival of those stocked fish has actually gone down over time too. So it might be that some of these lakes are actually simply warming up too fast and too much to support walleye populations, or at least naturally reproducing kind of and growing walleye populations. And so it could be that, you know, in some lakes you see a turnover from walleye to maybe more of a warm water species like a bass or bluegill populations, which is still okay. People like to fish for bass and bluegill too, but it might be just some lakes that are maybe deeper or larger, have better habitat for walleye. Those would be the ones most robust to climate change. And maybe those are ones where stocking or even just support of these naturally producing populations through things like harvest management or, you know, habitat management can be successful. So I think stocking is something that immediately comes to mind, but it's not a kind of cure-all. Mm-hmm. And we have to think carefully about kind of how we stock and where we stock and where it can actually be successful.
Along the lines of harvest management, how close is the population to the point that might justify prohibiting any walleye from being caught?
It really depends across the landscape. I mean, there are some places where we've done that. So the Minocqua chain of lakes, for example, in northern Wisconsin up in Biola's County, has been under a no walleye harvest management for quite a few years now because they're trying to rehabilitate that walleye population. So in some places, yes, it can become so extreme that you actually close harvest of walleye entirely because you're trying to keep those fish around, give them a chance to build their population numbers back up. And some lakes are very resilient to harvest, and they seem like they can take a lot of harvest. And part of the management then is finding those lakes that can do that versus the lakes that can't, and adjusting your strategies accordingly. You know, we track populations very closely in Wisconsin. We sample lakes on a rotation. We do, you know, 50 to 60 lakes a year. But there's 15,000 lakes, so you can't cover them all, but we're doing our best to try and understand which lakes are great, which lakes are having a hard time, and kind of adjusting accordingly.
We're checking in with Zach Feiner, DNR research scientist, as we talk about stresses to the walleye population. And field your questions. Call in questions and comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. You mentioned the Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission. How do you work with tribal nations in completing your walleye report and in the dynamics of understanding what is the future for walleye?
Yeah, I mean, we work very closely together to understand walleye and manage walleye. So the walleye in the ceded territory of Wisconsin, which is this area in the northern third of the state, where the tribes have the right to fish and hunt and gather, practice their lifeways on off-reservation lands, is jointly managed by the tribes and by the state. So there, GLIFWIC is a kind of intertribal agency that takes the tribes' management concerns into account, and they work very closely with the DNR to manage walleye and other wildlife populations, because the walleye are an incredibly important resource to the Ojibwe peoples of northern Wisconsin as well. Mm-hmm. You know, that spring harvest season is a major source of food. It has incredible traditional and cultural importance. This is a relationship between walleye and the Ojibwe that has gone back thousands of years. And they're very invested and interested in making sure that walleye are doing well as well.
How are fish that live in similar habitats to walleye reacting to warming winters?
That's a really excellent question. I mean, we started with walleye because that's where a lot of the data are. Like mm-hmm. I said, they're so important to our state and the people in our state that we study them really carefully. But there are lots of other cool and cold water species in Wisconsin that are projected to really struggle with climate change. Brook trout in our streams, for example, are projected to lose maybe 2/3 of their habitat because the streams are going to warm up too much for them to survive. Cisco, which is a kind of a smaller cold water lake species that's a really important food fish, and people also fish for them, has been extirpated from about 1/3 of our lakes already because it needs cold water and some of our lakes are warming up too much. So a lot of those cold water and cool water species, yellow perch, walleye, cisco, trout, are projected to have a hard time. On the flip side, there are some warm water species like bass, bluegill, crappie that can thrive in warmer waters. And we've seen some expansion of those species, and that may mean new opportunities on the landscape to fish for some of those species in the future.
In our last moments together, is there anything people can do to help protect walleye spawning?
Yeah, I mean, I think we talked a little bit about already, but, you know, think about the things you can control. What do you do how do you use the land on the edge of your lakes to promote water quality or protect spawning habitat, or, you know, follow harvest regulations? There are lots of things we can do to control the things we can control to boost the resiliency of walleye to climate change and other things that are more difficult to control on a local level. But there's a lot that people can do. Controlling invasive species is another one that people can do at the local level.
Zach, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Zach Feiner, research scientist at the Department of Natural Resources and UW-Madison's Center for Limnology, co-author of the study on walleye reproduction in the journal Limnology and Oceanography Letters. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We welcome The Washington Post's climate coach to field your questions on how to live more sustainably. A shout out to Louise in Milwaukee, who called in recently to suggest we discuss more solutions for climate change.
But specifically what we can do here in Wisconsin to address it.
Margot in Menominee and Val in Eau Claire both made similar requests in recent weeks. Val wrote, "What can I do in my everyday life to make a small difference in climate change?" Call in with a question or comment, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Michael Corin writes the climate coach advice column for The Washington Post, previously spent almost two decades as a journalist covering climate, technology, and economics. Michael, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Good morning. Your column looks at climate change from that personal perspective and how we can prevent it. What lifestyle changes have you made since you've been reporting on climate change?
That's a great question. Well, I've been thinking about this since grad school, so it's been about 20 years, so it hasn't just been the column. But, you know, since I had to start writing that and thinking about this on a daily basis, a few things that I've done. One is I just started tracking. So there's a way that you can actually hook up your credit cards to an app called Commons, and that gives you a very clear insight into what your emissions are based on what you're doing. And that's really illuminating, and it actually allows you first to get a handle on you know, what the impact is. And then I do things like compost, and, you know, I think about transportation a lot. So it's not, we have a car, but it's electric, and then we use bike and bus a lot. And, you know, most of all, you know, I think it's tricky because, you know, this is a systematic problem, and it's not that any one of us is going to be able to fix it. But the ability for, you know, anyone to demonstrate what's possible actually has a much larger effect because it affects people around you. And so I think about that even more than the individual action. So how can it affect people around you?
Can we go back to the credit card app for a moment here? So you're basically able to translate your purchases and show the impact on the planet. Can you give a little bit more?
Sure. So what you do is you hook up your credit cards to Commons and your bank account if you want, and it just looks at your transactions. So what are you buying? And each of those transactions has an estimated greenhouse gas emissions associated with it. And while it's not precise or at least perfect, it's pretty close. And so that at least gives you a ballpark understanding of what your emissions are. And then you have the choice of either reducing them or offsetting them or even just being aware of it. And when I talked with the founders of it, they mentioned that even just the awareness actually has a huge impact. Hmm. So people who don't necessarily offset their emissions actually reduce them just because they know.
You take questions from people who are confused about how they should live to further prevent climate change. What are some of the most common questions you get?
Well, let's see. EVs are a big one. Like, you know, what is the most efficient way to get around? Mm-hmm. And I think people are quite interested in that. Food is another one. And I get that quite a bit. I think people are really want to know about they're quite, you know, intuitive about where their emissions are coming from, which tends to be their home, their transportation, and their food. There are other questions, of course, but those are the three biggest.
And we're going to dissect those areas as we go on here. Something I wonder, though, there is that sentiment that individuals are not exactly to blame for the climate crisis, that we really need to look to corporations who should be liable for the decisions that they make. And, you know, because, you know, that is what will make the biggest difference. How do you feel about that line of reasoning?
It's a great question. It's not entirely wrong, of course. Companies are responsible in many ways for a lot of those emissions, as is policy. But if you look at the big picture and you look at how do we get to 2 degrees? So how do we keep temperatures from rising above 2 degrees? Behavioral change and individual action has to be part of that. So I don't see those as exclusive, and I don't think it's particularly productive to say, you know, it has to be this or that. Hmm. That is not to remove responsibility from any party, but it is just to say that to get where we need to go, we do need to be able to shift society at the individual level and as well as at the community level. Let me give you one good example. The emissions, the popularity of solar panels was studied, and they tried to figure out what is the most important factors in predicting whether someone would have solar panels on their roof. And obviously, this is a major piece of our emission reduction strategy. And the answer was not subsidies or geography or even wealth. It was primarily whether your neighbor had solar panels on their roof.
Wow.
And so it was even sort of a relationship between proximity. So the closer you are, the more likely you are to have them. So I think that is like the key here, is that we're not just talking about what do you do, but what do you do that then influences the system? And I try to focus on that in the column, is not just what do individual actions mean, but what do they mean in the larger system?
Talking with the Washington Post climate coach, Michael Corin is here as we get advice for how to live during this time of climate change. You can join in with your questions and comments for the climate coach, 800-642-1234. Michael, as you mentioned, rooftop solar, you've looked at how people can design homes to reduce their carbon footprint and deal with extreme weather. And you wrote how people are building roofs wrong. What is going on there?
Well, there's a better way in many cases if you're replacing your roof, or even if you just have a roof and you live in a very hot climate, which is called passive cooling. It's just one of the cheapest things you can do that it doesn't even cost you anything if you're already redoing your roof, that reduces your heating and cooling bills, or your cooling bills specifically. So just the idea that if you live in a hot climate, or even in the north, for example, in New York during the summer, you might have rooftop temperatures of 190 degrees Fahrenheit. And the original way to reduce that before we had, you know, mechanized cooling was through painting your roof white. That reflects a lot of radiation back into the sky. And so we have materials like that, but now we also have materials that don't even have the color. You can get any color you want, but they're reflective of basically this electromagnetic radiation, the sunlight, that puts it back into space and cools the temperature. It's not a huge effect, at least, you know, maybe a few degrees, or in some cases, it can, in terms of the interior temperatures, but mm-hmm. it can have a huge effect for a city. So there are cities now that are mandating this because it's such a public health risk when during the summer the temperatures in cities rises so much higher than the surroundings.
And think of how much roofing is done across cities in putting on new roofs. That could change an entire industry.
That's right. There's almost no reason not to do it since it's now the same cost. A lot of these shingles are the same cost as conventional ones. And if you want to go the full way, you can actually reduce your air conditioning cost quite a bit in hot climate. So I predict, you know, places like Phoenix and California and Florida, this will become pretty much standard, if not mandated. And there are places, further north where it does make sense.
How difficult is it in researching and answering the questions you get?
Well, luckily, like I said, I've been doing this for a long time, so I have a fair amount of experience kind of diving into the science and speaking with engineers. But it's not easy. It's not always easy because there's a lot of it depends. And so what I try to do is, like the last article was on electric vehicles, and a lot of people ask, well, is it cheaper to fill it up? And, you know, it's just not a comparison between the gallon of gasoline and a kilowatt hour of electricity, because you have to look at when do you charge and where do you charge. So we did a hypothetical road trip across the country, two of them actually, and then ran the numbers. And I think that kind of research goes a long way to helping people make informed decisions.
So you're really trying to see apples to apples on some of these issues when it's just not a nice, neat, clear distinction.
That's right. Yeah. And a case like that is relatively difficult. Where others, it's relatively simple, which is if you have a gas furnace, replace it with a heat pump. You don't need to do a ton of research to know the exact numbers because it's going to pay off.
Michael Corin, known as the climate coach, climate advice columnist at the Washington Post, our guide as we explore ways to live more sustainably. And you can call in with your question, your concerns, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Washington Post's climate coach, Michael Corrin, is here and up to the challenge of answering tough environmental questions with tips on what actions we can take today to help the planet. Call in with your question, your comment, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Marcus in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Good morning. So my question for your guest is, has there been any type of research or studies done looking at the reflectivity off of lighter colored roofs to perhaps offset some of the loss of ice pack that we're seeing at the poles?
Marcus, thank you. Goes with what we were talking about, Michael.
Yes, that's right. Actually, there has been. And if when you look at it in aggregate, considering how many basically rooftop surfaces there are in the world, it actually would have a global effect if we were able to convert most of those to these types of surfaces. So that's just to give you an order of magnitude potential. Obviously, not all of those will be converted, but if you want to think about it at the city level, you will reduce the temperature of a city, you know, measurably if we convert it to those rooftop passive surfaces. So we're actually in Phoenix, they're doing that for asphalt. So thinking about that for roads, really anything that's being hit by the sunlight would have that effect. So yes.
Let's turn to food. The United Nations urging everyone to eat more plants and less meat in order to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And yet meat consumption keeps growing every year. How beneficial is adopting vegan or vegetarian diets?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think it's a very charged one. Well, I think you're absolutely right. People still eat meat, and I think they will continue to want to eat meat. So that is something that we can't just ignore. And I think people are going to make that choice. But it doesn't have to be vegan or even vegetarian to have a big impact. You know, there's this idea of the 80-20 rule where 80% of the impact comes from 20% of the effort. Hmm. And in this case, that's also quite true. So most of our emissions are coming from beef and dairy, beef specifically, and at least it's how it's raised today. And so when you want to think about how can I reduce the impact, it really does not need to be vegan or vegetarian. You're welcome to do that, but you really could think about it more as, you know, essentially beef and sheep and to some degree is where most of those emissions are coming from. So that would be one way to just start to kind of slowly make a difference, but you get most of your results from that early change.
Here in Wisconsin, our nickname, the Dairy State. So
I know
you are in the midst of a big cheese state. Do Wisconsin residents have to give up cheese and brats completely? Do you have any tips on that?
Well, I don't think so. I actually, you know, even just a small reduction would have a huge impact. And I don't think that reduction would, and it would benefit a lot of people from a health perspective in other ways, which means maybe eating meat like twice a week instead of five. So I don't think that you'd have to give that up. And I wouldn't recommend that because I think we'd really, right at this point, only 5% of Americans identify as vegetarian and 2% as vegan. So it's not like that's going to become, I think, the majority. And a much better approach is to say, well, what makes sense for me personally? And then if you can look at that from an environmental perspective, you'll get most of the bang from your buck just from that early small reductions in meat consumption.
Talking with the Washington Post, climate coach Michael Corrin is here as we get advice for how to live during the time of climate change. You can join in with your questions, your comments, 800-642-1234. Chris is here in Port Wing. Chris, hi.
Good morning. Thanks for having this very important conversation. I wanted to suggest two things. One, your guest pointed out the idea of trying to keep global temperature average rise to 2 degrees. I'd like to suggest that a lot of scientists say it's important to try and keep it to 1.5. That was certainly the agreements made at Paris and other recent climate announcements. More than 1.5 leads to some pretty catastrophic effects, like 2 degrees would be pretty catastrophic, especially for the global south. The second thing I wanted to mention was that the narrative that individual actions are as important as mandates from government is a narrative that's been promoted by the fossil fuel companies. And in fact, if people want to try and have the biggest impact, they should talk to their representatives and get them to create mandatory policies to affect overall behaviors, like a carbon tax, like limits on the ability for companies to create large carbon effects. The largest 70 corporations in the world are responsible for about more than half of the carbon emissions. So we need to regulate and mandate these regulations at the state and federal government level. Thank you very much for your guest and your time.
Chris, thank you. That echoes what Tom and Wass called in to say, that it's important for people to reach out to all government representatives and not just talk to each other, so they know we're concerned about climate change and want something done about that. Michael, take it away on Chris's points.
Yeah, those are great points. I would love to see 1.5, and that is the agreement that we have, you know, that's been made at international conferences. We are fast pushing the time when 1.5 is going to be very difficult to reach, and even if we do everything today, it will be hard to get there. So I think we should try, and we should put everything we can behind it. The 2 degrees Celsius is going to be a very different planet and not one we are going to want to be on in the way that we hope. We need to every degree, every tenth of a degree matters. And so I just want to be clear that I think there's a tendency to be all or nothing on these targets, and it's a gradation. And I think it's as important to get as low as possible. And you also make some great points. You know, I 100% think that political action is going to be critical to essentially keeping temperatures at a stable or habitable point for much of the world. I do not see them as exclusive to actually taking personal action. And maybe more importantly, I see them as complementary. So, you know, the question is, how does political action happen? And oftentimes it is an effort by a small group of people at the individual and community level, and then ultimately at the political level, that moves the needle and makes things acceptable that once weren't in terms of regulation or mandates. And so I guess it's a both and sort of proposition more than either or. And again, it's not to take responsibility away from anyone, but I think it's important to say it's not just politics that matter.
Let's go to Vern in Eau Claire. Vern, hi.
Oh, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. So, like I say, aircraft are the number one transportation greenhouse gas emitter because the water cycle, you know, controls the Earth's temperature, basically. They contribute like 25%. But this cycle we're going through is not caused by mankind, and there's not much he can do about it. But you can, like I say, the aircraft, they fly 24/7. They're creating like a giant spider web of ice particles and water vapor in the atmosphere, upper atmosphere, along with CO2. And the only way to remove this CO2 is to go to what's called regenerative farming. But you can write to the White House, do everything you want to. It won't do any good.
Vern, thank you for calling in. Vern, wanting to talk about aircraft travel and the impact of planes.
Yeah, it's about 2% of emissions, definitely a significant global contributor. And we're going to need to come up with a new system besides burning fossil fuels to get there. And I think we already have some of the technology for short-haul flights to go electric. We're starting to see sustainable aviation fuel, which essentially is finding, in theory, carbon neutral or less low-carbon sources of fuel. But we definitely aren't there yet. That remains, I think, an unsolved problem. That's going to be much harder because you have to pack so much energy on a very small craft.
What do you think of those offsets where you buy your plane ticket and then you buy some type of carbon offset? Does that work?
Well, that's a very broad question. There are a lot of offsets that don't. Some of them are either outright fraudulent or just are not very effective. But I think some of them do. And the problem has been in the market is understanding which ones are which, and then finding ones that are affordable that have 100% certainty. And I think as you ratchet up the certainty in terms of emission reductions, you have to pay a lot more. So that's the conundrum we're in. I wouldn't throw the baby out with the bathwater with them, but I would say it's difficult to pick the right ones. That's a future column topic.
The Washington Post's Michael Corrin, climate coach, focusing on furthering the conversation on climate solutions. And you can talk with Michael at any point, call in with a question, share a comment, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The climate coach at the Washington Post, Michael Corrin, joins us to talk about the environment and potential climate solutions. A shout out to Louise in Milwaukee, Margot in Menominee, and Val in Eau Claire for suggesting we take on more climate and sustainability topics. You can join the discussion at any point. Call in with a question, a comment at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Michael, we heard from Dennis in Pensacola, wants to know if there have been studies comparing EVs and vehicles that burn fossil fuels when taking into account the manufacturing of the vehicle and its components and the use and disposal of batteries used for both.
That's an excellent question. There have been, and I'm actually going to be writing some feature columns on that topic. We can get into a lot of detail, but suffice to say, when you look at the lifetime emissions from a vehicle, the construction of that vehicle is the small percentage of the total emissions. It's almost all after you get to, you know, 10, it's like 50 or 100,000 miles, is really about the fuel you're burning, because you're basically amortizing all of those initial emissions from construction or manufacturing into the total. So just to say that, when you're buying an electric vehicle, the initial energy that goes into mining some of those minerals is a little bit higher. But over time, and you're basically looking at a payback within a few years in terms of emissions, you're seeing a much lower emission profile from an electric vehicle, assuming you're charging on an average grid in the United States.
You have also fielded questions about whether electric cars might crash our electric grid. What would happen if everyone started driving electric cars?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, we have, you know, case studies of this in Norway. I think the percentage of cars, electric vehicles sold in terms of the total share of vehicles is around 80%, I believe. It's well over 50. And, you know, the whole stock hasn't turned over, so there's still quite a few fossil fuel vehicles, but they haven't seen many problems in terms of bringing those onto the grid. And that's not to say that if we switch tomorrow, that wouldn't be a problem, but at the rate of adoption that we're seeing, electric vehicles could provide an asset more than a liability, because they charge at off hours typically. You're charging at night or even in during the day when there's high demand. My electric vehicle, for example, has a smart option that can charge based on when prices are lowest. And eventually you create a system where cars are essentially batteries that they can then supply energy back to the grid or to your house at peak hours, so they can shave those costs off or that load off. So in theory, we should actually treat them as a grid asset, not as a liability. But there has to be a lot of planning that goes into that.
When you talk about the mining and the transition to EVs and solar energy requiring lithium and cobalt and copper and nickel, and that can cause in itself environmental damage and human suffering, how can people mitigate these problems when adopting supposedly green technologies?
It's also a great question. And I think you're absolutely right. So mining in particular has massive impacts. Those are, I think, both on the environment, but particularly on societies and cultures near those mines. And that's been the history of mining since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. And so I think that needs to be at the forefront of, you know, our priorities when we're subsidizing and encouraging green technology. We also need to think about the impacts that fossil fuels have when we mine them, which at the moment is orders of magnitude larger than the clean energy economy. So I think something around 15 billion tons of fossil fuels are mined and extracted each year, which is about 500 times more than what we're extracting from the clean energy economy, or at least projected to do so. It may be less. I've seen numbers really kind of all over the map, but the reality is we're going to be mining a lot less minerals for the clean energy economy than the fossil fuel economy. So how do we prevent those impacts? I think that actually then does come down to both politics. So making sure that we have standards, which are starting to come into place for things like cobalt and other metals that are used in our vehicles and elsewhere, as well as our choice. You know, we have a choice of where to buy those cars, and to checking whether manufacturers make commitments to doing that responsibly.
Colleen in Madison wants to turn our attention to plastics, called in to ask about the amount of plastics we're using made from petroleum and not being disposed of correctly. What are your insights there?
Another very charged question, and one I want to write some more columns on, but I've actually had to take a lot of time to really study this. Look, I think when it comes to glass and metal and paper, these are pretty robust recycling systems. There's a relatively, you know, a decent price for those materials, and there's quite an extensive system to recycle them. Plastics do not have that at the moment. We can do that, of course. There are some plastics that can be at least reused, if not always, you know, recycled and put back into the system. But I guess, you know, I'm not going to say definitively what the answer is here because I don't know, but there's something called extended product liability. And if you think about it, right now we are subsidizing companies for their packaging. So they create packaging that can never be reused or recycled or isn't, and we pay as ratepayers to put that into a landfill. We also pay as in terms of the environmental impact on our communities and world. So I think when you pass something like extended product liability, you begin to address that market failure. And I think we should demand that of companies, that we don't subsidize packaging for them, that they make that our goods with things that can be recycled or can be recovered in some way. And we certainly aren't there yet, but we're moving in that direction with other minerals and other materials.
The Washington Post climate coach Michael Corin with us as we look to how to live more sustainably in climate change and taking your questions and comments. 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. We got an email here, Mary, wanting to know if solar rebates for residential installation are going to become more available and affordable for homeowners in the near future. What is the outlook, Mary asks?
The outlook is very good at the moment. There is quite a bit of options available, basically for what's called electrification. So it's not just solar, but actually taking your home, taking individual fossil fuel powered appliances, as well as your electrical system, and then getting quite a bit back. And if you're middle to low income, these are unprecedented incentives. I think there's a good site that you can go called Rewiring America, and they will, you just plug in some of your zip code and some information, and it will tell you what's available. I will say it's a little difficult to claim some of these still, because the Inflation Reduction Act, which was just passed, they're still working out the details. But if you're looking at, let's say, an electrification project where it's solar and you're replacing maybe a gas furnace, there's thousands and sometimes tens of thousands of dollars on the table.
One of the concerns about solar farms is that they're taking over valuable farmland or undeveloped land. Is there a problem with where our country is building solar farms?
Another great question. They're absolutely correct. There is a lot of land that is needed for wind and solar. And so siting that is going to be one of the great challenges going forward. There's already 8,000 projects that are just waiting to be approved so they can plug in. to the grid, and we don't have a streamlined solution for this yet. But it's not necessarily exclusive. So if you're using land for wind, it is not, you know, preventing the use for agriculture. And the same with solar, actually. So a growing number of projects are called agrivoltaics. And so essentially you're able to both grow food, particularly vegetables, and have solar on the same property. And given that you're seeing $500 to $1,000 an acre for some solar leases, it's a very competitive offer. And so going forward, we're going to need to do, I think, some of both, which is site solar panels on brownfields, rehabilitated mines, landfills, things like that. But we also need to find ways that we can sort of do both. And I think that's possible. We're going to need a lot of renewable electricity, and it can't all come from wind.
What about empty parking lots? Bloomberg's City Lab estimates about 2 billion parking spots are being used by about 200 million cars. Why are few solar arrays being built over parking lots to get dual use out of that land?
That's a fantastic suggestion, and I think it should be. And there are very small cases where it is. I don't think it's two challenges, let's say. One is cost. So it's always harder to build on places where you have to get permissions and permitting and talk to many different owners. And so there are some transaction costs there. So I think we really need to figure out, and this is not true in other countries, where the permitting process and streamlining that. And, you know, I think we're going to probably move in that direction, as you said. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of, you know, prioritizing it and creating the national imperative behind it. But we just haven't done that yet. And I think once we do, and once it becomes plug and play, then we'll get there a lot faster. But it's going to take some time.
Matt in Madison emailed to say mass transit is the answer. Individuals using the amount of resources required for one electric car is unsustainable, and we need a public transportation option, a robust one. What do you make of Matt saying, look, we have to use public transit?
Yes. I mean, I'm a big fan. I ride it almost every day, and I ride my bike, and I have a car. I don't use that car very often, but you know, I think most Americans in this country do have a car. And unfortunately, the solution, if Matt is correct, we should have cities that we don't need, or even communities where we don't need vehicles to get around. Hmm. And I think we don't have those right now. And we need to prioritize those to get to a place. I think that would actually make us all well off. I should say that a lot of these things that we talk about are sometimes framed as sacrifices, but they really aren't. They really do contribute to the quality of life in many ways. So at the moment, I guess I meet people where they are, which is they have a car or need a car to get around in some ways, and we need to transition to a place where that is not the only option that they have or the only thing they need for mobility. So again, It's a tough problem that's going to require a social, societal answer. But in the meantime, we do need to transfer a lot of these vehicles to electric propulsion or alternative fuels as we build communities that are better linked.
The Washington Post, Michael Corin writes the Climate Coach Advice column, and its newsletter is tackling thorny questions about the climate crisis, offering solutions for sustainability along the way. Call in with a question for the Climate Coach, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. What a pleasure to have the Washington Post climate coach, Michael Corin, whose work focuses on furthering climate solutions and sustainability in our everyday lives. You can discuss your climate question. The number is 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Mike in Shell Lake. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
What would you like to ask the climate coach?
Well, I'd like to ask a question and point a thing out. One, when are they going to get these cars to an affordable price that the common person can just can buy and own and be able to operate them? And when are they going to get it to where you get the same distance out of a charge that you do a full tank of gas?
Mike, thank you for those questions. First, the timeline, and then, you know, getting as much mileage as in a tank of gas, Michael.
Great questions. So let's see the price. When Tesla first launched, their explicit model was to say, we're going to build a very expensive car, and then we're going to use that money to build a less expensive car, and then we're going to use that money to build a mass market vehicle. So we're probably on step two, realistically, of that plan, and that goes for other electric vehicle companies as well, even though Tesla will say that their Model 3 is mass market, and it is around the median price of a car today. But his point is valid, that we really haven't seen that happen at low prices, primarily because prices of cars generally have gotten so high, and people are willing to pay a premium for these electric vehicles. And so you've basically seen the automakers sell luxury and expensive models of their electrics rather than double down on these cheaper ones. One of the exceptions, which has been really interesting to watch, is the Chevy Bolt. Great vehicle. People love it. It had a slow start, and Chevy initially said it was going to discontinue, and then they recently came back and said, no, we're going to build as many as we can. We're selling them all. And those technically start around $26,000. And I think that's with incentives. And so we're really getting now into a point where these vehicles are just starting to hit the market that are below the median price of a vehicle. And that's actually up above $40,000 today. So he's absolutely right that most aren't. But I think in the next 2 to 3 years, you're going to see a lot more hit the market.
And as more hit the market, will mileage improve?
And you are seeing mileage improve. So, you know, I think that is going to be a process. We're going to see steady improvements in lithium ion, and that's getting us to 250 to 350 mileage per charge. And then we're starting to see new technologies. So the latest that I've seen is 600 or 700 miles for a charge, which would be more than any tank in an average vehicle. But at the same time, I want to emphasize that we don't necessarily need 700 miles in a vehicle, and that as charging infrastructure improves and it speeds up and we're seeing those start to emerge, we're not going to need these big batteries to drive around these cars. We can actually fill up very quickly at a very low cost, usually at home overnight. And so it'll be a tension, a trade-off between, can we pack as much battery into the car as possible, to can we just have a smaller battery that we, you know, works very well and charges quickly?
Let's bring in Dave in Sheboygan. Dave, what's on your mind?
Hey, great show. Love the topic. I'm a lover of Mother Earth. She needs a break. So my comment is, even though I want to get into the electrified world sooner than later, there's too much range anxiety out there. And range anxiety, if you don't know, is you got this, you know, you paid $80,000 for your, you know, whatever, and it goes, it's got 500 miles per charge. Within a week, you will have range anxiety. So I don't want to live that way. I'm a hybrid guy, and I think the hybrids will get even more sophisticated, where the engine will happen less and less and less and less. And I think right now, if you keep your car under 40 miles an hour on some of these hybrids, the engine never turns over. You know, let's make that 60 miles an hour and the engine never turns over. But you've got it if you need it. Range anxiety. Bye-bye.
Dave, thank you for calling in. Michael, you know, bringing hybrids into this conversation.
Yeah, and I wrote that column recently about EV range, and a lot of people are about hybrids, and a lot of people love them. And I think if you live in a place where you don't have extensive electric charging infrastructure, they're a good option. And many people have found that they barely even use the engine, which is great. The long-term future, it's a little unclear to me. I think we're probably going to see a world in which having two propulsion systems, so gasoline and battery, isn't the most efficient. It does cut your range for battery and for gasoline, or just for your battery, excuse me. Mm-hmm. And so it makes sense and will continue to make sense for a while, I think, for people who live in these areas. But once the infrastructure is there and the batteries have improved, it will probably economically no longer make sense. But in the meantime, they're a good option.
I want to land on the brutal heat waves and that are alarming people that climate change is happening now. And you say the world needs a new way to talk about heat. What is problematic about the way people talk about extreme heat?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, humans are not really accustomed to some of the temperatures that we're seeing and projected to see over the next 100 years. And the reason is that temperature and humidity interact to become more dangerous than it might seem by the thermometer alone. So, for example, if you're at 100 degrees with high humidity, that's potentially lethal. And we're seeing those types of conditions more and more often as the planet warms and as more water enters the atmosphere, water vapor enters the atmosphere. And so when we talk about, there's lots of different ways to measure this, and I got into that in the column. The most straightforward is the heat index. That is going, sometimes it's called real field temperature. Basically, that's going to look at both the different conditions around you and say, what's the risk to your health? And, you know, heat is a leading killer around the world because it stresses your heart and your lungs and your cardiovascular system. And so if you're at risk or you have any risk factors, that can be quite dangerous. And then when it's very humid, then you have something called the wet bulb globe temperature. And that was originally designed for the military when they were doing drills and people were passing out or even dying on the field. And that tries to say, if things are very humid and very hot, where is it safe? And there's a lot of rules around that. So in the next couple of years, expect to see, I think, meteorologists and just even everyday people talk more and more about heat index and maybe even wet bulb globe temperature.
We have just a few seconds left, but in writing about climate change, has it made you more or less hopeful?
You know, humanity has always figured it out. We've always found ways to fix problems that we're dedicated to solving. I don't think we're going to emerge from the next century without serious damage and displacement for a lot of people. And we're already starting to see that, of course. But when you do look at the numbers, when you look at the technology available and what needs to be done, there are no shortage of plans. There are no shortage of feasible plans to get where we need to go. Whether we as a society and whether we as a world decide to do that
remains to be seen. Yes,
the cost is only a few percentage points of GDP. Then I think
Michael, we're out of time. Thank you for joining us. Michael Corrin writes the Climate Coach Advice column for the Washington Post. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.